The points that we did not discuss that much are actually probably the central and the most relevant. I gave a lecture around 2 years ago on the role of the press in the Monroe-Filowinski issue, if I could digress a little bit. And I actually drew upon this passage of the Sefer HaYikarim for some insight as to the role of the press in exposing personal infidelities and shortcomings of political leadership. And here is the issue. If you remember, the Sefer HaYikarim's question that he deals with towards the end of his essay is the distinction between the sin of Shaul HaMelech, that when Shaul failed to eradicate Amalek, so God basically said, you're out of here, right? You're finished. No second chance, in spite of the fact that Shaul apparently did Shuvah. And then we look at David HaMelech, who sinned with Bathsheba, and although David did suffer tremendously, there was a miscarriage, and then, of course, the whole rebellion of Avshalom afterwards was a function of the divine punishment. But nevertheless, the Malchut remained with David HaMelech. And not only that, but in fact, the Malchut comes via Shlomo to Moshiach, and Shlomo is the child that he had with Bathsheba. Now, we do know that the Gemara, to some degree, tells us that the sin was not as egregious and as obvious as one would have assumed. In other words, technically, Bathsheba may have been divorced, etc., because when soldiers went to war, they gave a divorce. But nevertheless, we do see that the prophet does describe it as adultery, does describe it as murder. So in a spiritual sense, it was a very, very bad thing. So why is David given multiple chances? So the Sefer HaYikarim gives different theories and explanations, but I think two points in particular emerge with crystal clarity that we should remember. If there's any part that one should remember, this would probably be the one, and there are two distinctions that he offers. And you'll see how this is very relevant for the Clinton issue. The first distinction is that Shaul's failure was a failure in the execution of his duties as a king. Part of his royal duty as a melech, he was charged with the eradication of Amalek, and this was what you would call misfeasance or nonfeasance or malfeasance in the performance of his responsibility as a monarch, and therefore the failure to carry out the duties that one has by virtue of their office is grounds for removal from that office. As opposed to David HaMelech, although the sin was very, very serious, the sin was not a sin, at least the adultery part, was not a sin in his capacity as melech. It was a private moral failing, which is between him and God. But nevertheless, the Sefer HaYikarim wants to suggest the violation of a personal duty that one owes to God. Although obviously it's sinful, obviously you need Shuvah, obviously one needs to make amends. We're not at all minimizing it. But in terms of being disqualified from office, that is not necessarily a disqualifier from office. Yeah. Well, it really depends. One, the Sefer HaYikarim doesn't go into this. I mean, one might differentiate the two aspects of the sin, meaning the simple fact that he was with Bathsheba may not have been an abuse of power. Certainly sending Uriah to the front was, in fact, a military decision, a governmental decision. That's a difficulty. And then, of course, the other difficulty is, even in terms of the sexual relationship, there may have been an abuse of power in the sense of the looking at it in modern terms, in the sense of the reality of consent. You know, when the king summons you, do you have... I mean, that's very true, and you can understand that this is part of the contemporary issue now, with, you know, abuse of power, sexual harassment, and those issues. But what's interesting is that it's very similar, Lahavdil, to a debate under constitutional law. You know, the Constitution says, this came up, I mean, with Clinton, and it came up with Nixon. The Constitution says that a president can be impeached for what are called high crimes and misdemeanors. That is the phrase in the Constitution. Now, there are many constitutional law scholars that say that the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors has a technical term that refers to carelessness or negligence in the carrying out of the duties of the office. So, for example, it does not refer to a crime. For example, theoretically, if a president goes into a bar and just shoots somebody with his private firearm, there are constitutional scholars that maintain that is not sufficient grounds for impeachment. It must be connected to the office itself. Now, what would that mean? I'm not sure. Would the president be president from a jail cell? You know, it's not clear how that would work, but there is a theory in constitutional law that you must trace an impeachable offense to something pertaining to the operation of the government and not simply crimes that a president commits as a private individual. That's exactly the point the Sefer Yikarim makes in the first point. Now, he then gives a second answer, and you see these two answers cut in different ways, in which he says the following. The primary distinction between David and Shaul was not in the magnitude of their sin. Maybe David's sin was worse than Shaul's sin. It could very well be. But the difference was how they responded when they were confronted with evidence of their guilt. And here's the point. It's very, very clear if you just read the biblical verses how Shaul engages in both denial and then blaming other people. Shaul's first response is, right when Shmuel says, "Why didn't you kill Amalek?" And Shaul's first response is, "Well, I did." And Shaul says, "No, you didn't. You didn't complete the job." And then he says, "Well, I was afraid of the people. The people were pressuring me to take all the sheep and everything else." So what you see with Shaul is a consistent idea of either denying responsibility or passing the buck onto someone else. With David HaMelech, of course, the most outstanding feature of his tshuva was that when Nathan HaNavi came to him with the famous parable of the rich man and the poor man, and he talked about the poor man taking the rich man taking the poor man's sheep, etc., and for a banquet, and such a man is wretched. And when Nathan HaNavi said to him, "Ata ha'ish, you are that person," David says, "Chatati, I have sinned." There is no evasion. There is no equivocation. There is no blaming someone else. And therefore, the Sefer Yikarim says that the sign of true leadership, under this interpretation, is not that you never fail, because in fact, failure might be part of the human condition in many cases, but that you are willing to take the responsibility for that failure, to make amends, to do tshuva, not to evade and not to blame others. Last week we mentioned the story of, or 2 weeks we mentioned the story of Elazar ben Dordia, which makes that same point in a graphic way. Now, it's interesting. You can literally transpose these two answers onto the contemporary situation, and this mirrors the debates. One argument is, hey, this is personal. What I do in my own time, what I do not connected to the government, is nobody's business. Right? That's kind of answer number one. Answer number two says, yes, it's not so much what you did, but it's the evasions, it's the lack of responsibility. So the contemporary debates can actually be mirrored in these multiple understandings of the difference between Shaul and David.
I think that Shaul was in a very difficult situation, though, compared to the situation that David HaMelech Donis Sachin, because when Shaul accused him of not doing what he should, the people were still in turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
The thing had yet to be done correctly, and so he was under a lot of pressure, whereas David could sit and reflect, and obviously what he did was terrible.
Well, it might be so. You're making a very interesting point that Natan confronted David in absolute privacy. There was no one else in the room, as far as we know. And Shmuel is confronting Shaul in the midst of all the people. You're correct there. That might be a difference. But nevertheless, these are the two primary points that the Sefer Yikarim makes. Now, by the way, you may remember there's a long footnote there from the translator, Professor Husik. He just quotes a passage of the Talmud, because in describing Shaul, there's a phrase, Shaul's war against Amalek, there is a phrase, Vayarev Banachal, he fought or he quarreled in the valley, which seems to be describing the military scene, but there's a long passage in the Talmud that says that Vayarev, he quarreled, does not refer to the military battle itself, but it refers to the internal monologue that Shaul had with himself. And that is, Shaul convinced himself, because of the law of the Torah concerning the valley, which we'll describe in a moment, that he should spare Amalek's, the king of Amalek's, life. And that law refers to Egla Arufa. This is in the book of Deuteronomy. This is the heifer whose neck is broken. Again, it's an unusual halacha. It's not practiced today. But the halacha says that if you find a corpse, and we do not know who murdered the person, so we measure to the closest city. You find a corpse between two cities. So you measure from the closest city. By the way, the Talmud has all sorts of discussions. Do you measure from the nose? Do you measure from the feet? Is that the same, right? What if the head is, you know, what if there's a decapitation? Right? There are all sorts of questions about Eglah Rufa. But be it as it may, you measure from the closest city, and the elders of the city bring a calf, and they lay their hands, they wash their hands. Like the whole idea of, well, doesn't enter Christianity. We wash our hands of this. Comes from the Yad Ha'arufa, in which these Zakenim exonerate themselves by washing their hands, and they lay their hands on the Egla, and they ask God for forgiveness. And the Talmud explains, why do they ask God for forgiveness? They didn't do any murder, but the assumption is that in the absence of any evidence, we assume that the crime was committed by someone from the closest city, and the Zakenim need to make a public confession that perhaps we were guilty, perhaps we did not treat the stranger in our midst with proper hospitality, perhaps we weren't concerned for his safety, perhaps we created a dangerous environment, because leaders have a responsibility to create communities that are welcoming to the outsider, and therefore there's Egel Arufa. So Shaul made the following bit of spurious pilpul in his mind, and he said, if the Torah makes such a big deal about one person who was murdered, that we have to go through this whole rigmarole, and it's called Nachal because the Egla is brought to a Nachal, to a river valley, then Kal Bachomer, a fortiori, how much more so should I be concerned about not eradicating a whole nation? Because he made a Kal Bachomer, that's what it means. He quarreled with Hashem based on God's own precedent. And that's the Talmudic interpretation. But of course, the Talmud remarks on this, a very important idea. And it says, Kol Hamarachem Al Ha'achzar, Sofo Lehitachzar Al Hamarachem, which means anyone that shows mercy when it's necessary to show cruelty will eventually show cruelty towards those whom you should show mercy. Because this same Sha'ul that seemed to be motivated by mercy and compassion for the people of Amalek, when it came time to find David that he was pursuing, and the city of Nob, the city of the Kohanim, gave food and shelter to David, he massacred the entire city. Because the concept is, if we allow, this is really the idea of halakha generally, if we allow our emotional responses to dictate how we deal with a situation, then we are very, very subjective, and we will tend to define the good by the expedient and the convenient. And consequently, sometimes we will think we are motivated by mercy when in fact there may be some other factor involved. And when we think it's to our self-interest, we may behave in a very cruel way. Right? So that's the Talmudic interpretation of Vayarev Banachal. He quarrels with God based on God's own precedence of the Egla Rufa that was brought into the Nachal Eitan, the river valley. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm not addressing the reality of anyone's tshuva.
So it's interesting to bring that up and see where it diverts. The other question I have is, so I would like to know, then why, how is it that the Davidic dynasty does continue to believe and
what you see basically is the power of tshuva. Now, this is a difficult issue. You know, I tell you why it's a difficult issue. It's a difficult issue even in the Jewish community. I got a call the other day from a reporter for the Baltimore Jewish Times. There's apparently a story in Baltimore. I don't know who the person is. I don't know anything about it at all. About a religious functionary who was involved in embezzlement and tax fraud and pleaded guilty. Again, I don't know anything about the story. And the question is whether the religious functionary should be allowed to keep his job. He was fined and given probation, but should he be allowed to keep his position as a religious functionary? Now, you see, this is a very, very... of course, there are issues of rabbis who are guilty of worse, of sexual improprieties and the like. And this is a genuinely, I think, difficult issue for a Jewish community, because on one hand, we believe totally in the redemptive power of sincere tshuva. We don't mean cheap grace, as the Christians sometimes call it. We mean a tshuva in which there's regret, in which there's commitment, in which there's resolution. Of course, although we can never really measure that. On the other hand, particularly when you're dealing with a person who's supposed to exercise religious leadership, who's supposed to exemplify, following the Torah, following the commandments, does tshuva cancel that out? Meaning to say, it's one thing to say, you're forgiven, God loves you, go back to being a good Jew, and, in the world to come, everything will be fine. But on the other hand, is that the person that should be, you know, the principal of our school, the teacher of our children, the rabbis of our synagogue, the chazan of the Beit Knesset? It's a genuinely difficult issue, because on one level, if you say, you made a mistake, you're out of here, what we're also communicating is, we don't really think tshuva counts for very much. So it's a hard one. Now you do see from David, on one level, the tremendous power of tshuva. And in fact, there's even an idea in the Zohar. The Zohar makes this fascinating idea that, you know, in Egypt, Yosef was really the king of the Jews, so to speak. Yosef was the second in command to Paro. Yosef was the one who was really the leader of the Jewish people in Egypt, at least, you know, until they became slaves and the like. So the question the Zohar asks is, why was Malchut not given to Yosef? Why was ultimate Malchut given to Yehuda? So the Zohar says the fascinating idea that when Yosef is subjected to sexual temptation, Yosef does not succumb. Yosef simply says no to Potiphar's wife. Yehuda with Tamar fails, and later David fails. And there is a concept that since a melech is supposed to be a role model of sorts, sometimes the ideal role model is one who teaches us that after failure and mistake, there is redemption, as opposed to the person who's too perfect. There's almost a model, and again, one has to work on this because obviously it would create difficulties. That's why, you know, I remember hearing back in 1992 when Clinton first ran for president and the allegations of his extramarital affairs came to light. So Clinton started talking. I have to admit, this resonates to me very, very powerfully. He started talking about, well, the idea of life is, you know, redemption with repentance and resolution, and you go on, and, you know, and I am you know. But the truth is, the matter, that's a very, very powerful idea. It may not be said sincerely, and that's the problem. But it's a very, very powerful idea that is reflected in the Kabbalistic explanations, that specifically there was a certain flaw in our malchut to show us the power of tshuva and the ability to come back from defeat. And in fact, I mentioned before that, you know, there's a whole genre of Jewish religious literature now, biographies of great rabbis and scholars. You know, Moshe Feinstein, you can find these rabbis. And somebody once complained, a very eminent person once complained, that these biographies all emphasize, you know, when they were 4-year-old, they knew the whole Talmud, and when they were 6 years old, they, you know, they knew the Jerusalem Talmud, you know, these fantastic accomplishments, which there's no possible way, you know, what message does that have for us? You know, we read it and we're amazed, but, you know, it's not anything we can do, nothing our kids can do. But this person emphasized that, you know, perhaps a different type of writing would emphasize the struggles and even the failures that these great people had in the course of their lives, and how they overcome the obstacles to become great. Because that is, in other words, a record of coming back after a failure and a mistake is sometimes a much more inspirational and powerful message than the message of this person's always perfect. And the Zohar makes the point of David and that. But again, how that plays out in the case of the rabbi that had an affair with a member of the congregation, very, very difficult. I mean, you see that in the Christian ministries, there is indeed this problem of what Paul called cheap grace, where, you know, you just get up and say, I'm sorry, and, you know, everything goes back again. Judaism believes in tshuva, but tshuva is not for free. Tshuva requires the payment of, you know, a price of soul-searching, of commitment, of real change. And the question is, how do human beings measure that, right? God can measure it. How can we measure the reality of tshuva? So it's a real, real dilemma, and unfortunately, as society gets more immoral, I think it's a dilemma that we're going to see more and more, even in the Jewish community itself. Yeah.
Can I just make an announcement? Anybody got a Deutsche Caravan outside?
I'm sorry. You should have interrupted right away.
Hi.
Hi.
And you said role of press.
Say again?
The role of the
press. I was going to say, yeah, the reason why it's relevant to the role of the press is the following. There is, in Judaism, as all of us know, laws against Lashon Hara. You're not supposed to just expose derogatory information about people. However, to the extent that the exposing of derogatory information is necessary to enable us to make decisions regarding our leaders, that would be legitimate. So what I'm suggesting is, whether personal dirt on someone is relevant to their qualifications for leadership would actually depend on these different positions. And consequently, like the Seferi Koim's first distinction, it might be illegitimate to expose private dirt on someone. Like the second distinction, it would be relevant in terms of showing a lack of responsibility and evasion. And of course, even with Watergate. Now, Watergate, I guess most people here were alive during Watergate. It's amazing to think that when my law students, most of them were not even born then, so really getting old. But in Watergate, you know, Watergate, of course.
Explain that to some of the younger people,
friends. Well, there was this thing called Vietnam. Okay, but anyway, the thing is that Watergate, which clearly involved, you know, abuses of governmental power, but even in Watergate, the ultimate impeachable offense was much more connected to the cover-ups than the tapping or the breaking.
That's also
the
breach of power.
No, both were, yeah.
No, but
yeah.
A cover-up, obstruction of justice with the person,
right,
who's sworn to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States.
That's right.
It's a core issue.
So the evasion, particularly when you use
the legal structure,
mm-hmm, is a separate basis. So often we find the way one responds to the crime is a crime that is much greater than the crime.
On that note, I was just thinking when you were talking about the principle of how powerful that statement, you know, I come back and now I'm stronger than so.
I use it over and over. I tell you, I'm a sucker for it, tell you the truth, because it is the message of Tshuva and Yom Kippur and everything else. But as you said, when people do it for money, for power, for glory, for political office, you know, I can respect someone that says, I'm leaving politics because I've decided, you know, to devote my life to make myself a better person. That's a different statement that says, vote for me because I'm a changed person. It is a very different thing.
And I think the press really took Clinton to task when he was denying everything.
Yeah.
And then switched when he finally said yes.
Yeah. The press itself changed. I don't want to get into this because it's not really irrelevant, but the press has changed tremendously because everyone knows, for example, with FDR and Eisenhower and everything, there were all sorts of things that it was just understood that reporters did not write about. There was a concept, we don't write about people's private lives. And at some point, that totally broke down. I mean, there's no such concept anymore of a private life.
I was wondering why the notion that Swiss Alvos plays a big role here, that reason why, like, David kept his dynasty was not merely because of David, but because he kept the Yehuda, while Shaul came from Benjamin, therefore, you know, had this slack.
Okay, but first of all, keep in mind, though, that to a large degree, the Zechut Avot of Yehuda itself is predicated on the idea of assuming responsibility. So, in effect, it's not so much my grandfather was good, but rather David incorporated that very same trait. But you are hitting on actually another interpretive question, which the Rav Albert does not go on, and we didn't go on. I'll just mention very briefly. That is, there's a well-known question on this whole problem. And that is, the implication of the narrative in Shmuel is that had Shaul not committed his sin, his malchut would have continued. In other words, David came on the scene only as a result of Shaul being disqualified. And yet, if you look at the blessings that Yaakov gave upon his deathbed to his children, he gave a blessing that the malchut of the Jewish people should always be from the tribe of Yehuda, from whom David is a descendant. And in fact, all the commentaries say, the Rambam writes, for example, that the only reason Shaul was a melech to begin with was Shaul was a transitional king, because the Jews didn't ask for it the right way, they attacked Shmuel, and therefore Hashem didn't want to give them the permanent monarchy. So you have a problem. Was Shaul intended to be a temporary monarchy to begin with? Or was there a forfeiture only because of sin? And if there was only a forfeiture because of sin, does that mean Shaul's monarchy would have continued? But that would be inconsistent with the blessing that Yaakov gave to his children on his deathbed. Right? That itself is a difficult question that many of the Rishonim struggle with. Nachmanides gives as an answer that somehow the Malchut would have certainly gone to the Davidic line irregardless or irrespective of that. But Shaul would have had an honorary role as governor or prime minister or some type of secondary monarchy. There would have been a malchut of... Actually, I once heard from a student of mine that she suggested the following very intriguing explanation. That, if you remember, one of David's wives was Shaul's daughter, Michal. There was no surviving child that he had from Michal. But perhaps, if Shaul had not sinned, the royal line would have come from Michal, and therefore every Davidic king would have also been a descendant of Shaul. Perhaps via the mother, that might be a possibility of how you reconcile that. So, yeah.
What about the responsibility of the one who forgives? In retrospect, we all have 20/20 vision. But at the time that the sinner is doing tshuva, what is the responsibility of the one who is asked to forgive, i.e. the people, in terms of Clint, in terms of Barry, in terms even of David?
Well, you see, you understand, though, that there are multiple layers of forgiveness here. In other words, talk about Barry, right? I mean, there is forgiveness to the individuals that you have hurt by betrayal, such as wife, children, etc. And then there's forgiveness to the population whose trust... Right? But those are totally different aspects. What are the responsibilities? Well, again, we get into this idea... Certainly Maimonides writes, based on the Gemara, that when someone sincerely asks for forgiveness, so lo yehei achzari, one should not be cruel, one should forgive. But the point is, though, forgiveness does not have to mean reinstatement and voting for somebody. And those are two different things. Forgiveness means, you know, I love you, you're a good person, I wish you to have a good life, and may God help you to achieve those things that you're good at. But that doesn't mean I have to give you the family car. We have to differentiate that. Meaning it's not a punishment, it's not a sanction, it's not a rejection. It's simply saying the person is not competent necessarily for the position that he was elected for.
Are the rabbis as precise in how one judges the sincerity of who asks for forgiveness as they are about the sinner? I mean, the steps for doing tshuva seem to be much more detailed than the judging when it's important to know.
Yeah.
It's
very true. But you know that on one hand we really cannot gauge sincerity, and the general approach is that if we look at others with compassion, so we merit the divine compassion. But you know, it is true. I'll give you an example of this. You know, very often before Yom Kippur, it's customary and proper that we go to different people that we may have hurt, and we ask their forgiveness. We say, "Will you forgive me?" And often we just say, "Sure, I forgive you. Don't bother me." You know. But the point is this: that to truly forgive someone means that you don't bear in your heart any resentments or hurts. And therefore, it is a process that requires work on the part of the forgiver, as well as the person asking forgiveness. Again, I use the word cheap grace because that's such an evocative term. It's used in Christianity, it's an evocative term of what tshuva is not. It's not this automatic thing. And they tell the story about a man who went to a very great tzaddik, Rav Elia Lapyad, and asked his forgiveness for something. And he figured, this is such a wonderful, righteous man, of course he'll say, "I forgive you." Like, you know, everyone says, "I forgive you" right away. And Rav Elia Lapyad said, "I have to think about it." And the person was really taken aback. He absolutely did not expect this great man to say the answer. And Rav Elia said, "Come back to me in 3 days." And the man came back to him in 3 days, and Rav Lapyad helped him, kissed him, said, "You know, I didn't want to just forgive you when I still felt a little hurt. So I worked on myself, and I reflected, and I tried to develop in myself empathy and compassion. And now I can forgive you, and now you're my friend." You're correct. We often don't think about the responsibilities and the work on the part of the forgiver. But ultimately, as you know, it is ultimately to our benefit to be forgivers. It's not simply the kindness we do to the other, but if we allow ourselves to be overcome by anger and resentment, we destroy ourselves. Actually, a very eloquent statement of this. This was back to Nixon. Nixon, when he resigned, although he's hardly an example of this, but he made a whole point. He says, "Those who," he said something, I still remember this, "you know, those who allow themselves to be possessed by envy and jealousy just destroy themselves with it." That was his last words before he left the White House. And that's a very, very true sentiment.
That's not a bad thing.
Yes, that's right. It just destroys a person.
I can see this
you know, when people are, I see this working sort of for removing people from power, because we tend to think also of the good things that they've done, and that gives us a lot of empathy for them. Mm-hmm. But all things being equal, let's say it's four people have achieved a position of power, and you have, say, two candidates or whatever, are we then to seek the person that's done sin and done teshuvah over the person that has it?
It's very hard to say. In other words, I would have to say, just to limit this, I would have to say that these decisions can be made by God only. Meaning to say, we, you know, we should generally go for the most moral person, but God, for various reasons, puts certain people in historical grandeur to teach us certain lessons. And those lessons are important, but that doesn't mean, you know, let's seek out the biggest degenerate we can find and show us. But then, of course, I'll give you another political issue. And again, I'm not going to definitively answer this. I'll just throw it out as a question for pondering. And this comes up a lot. Let's say you have someone who is, let's say, pro-Israel. Right? Pro-Israel is very, very good for the Jews. But the person might be of degenerate moral character. And then you have some other person, you know, perfect family man, absolutely honest. He just happens not to support the issues that we or anyone, whatever it is, may consider important. Do you vote the person? Do you vote the issues? Right. It's a similar type of idea. Now, one might say there is a difference between Jewish leadership, religious leadership in particular, and political leadership, because it might be that a Jewish religious leader should be some type of role model, and therefore moral character is the single most important thing. One might say, in this day and age, though, political leaders are not role models for morality, and consequently, you put in the guy that'll get the job done. That might be one way of looking at it, meaning, I don't care. In fact, even with Clinton, that was an issue, because on one hand, you know, Clinton is accused of treating women in a very, very despicable way. On the other hand, politically, he's very good for feminist issues, right? So that's the issue, you know. And these are difficult issues. The issue of splitting the political decision-making process from the personal. And all I want to show you, again, without resolving these issues, is that the Sefer HaKarim actually sees some of this tension in the analysis of David Sin and Shaul Sin.
Just something, how
relevant
is this to you when we look at the fact that Shaul did so much of Shiva, but even Moshe, we can't, you know, say that God didn't forgive, can we? Or are we supposed to assume that God just felt that they were not, you know, she was saying, able then to leave.
Yeah, that's right. I think we have to clearly understand, certainly God forgave Moshe. Moshe did Tshuva, God forgave Moshe. I mean, the concept is not that God didn't forgive Moshe, but the concept is that Moshe was now disabled from occupying that particular position for the reasons that we discussed. Certainly, in terms of divine forgiveness, there's certainly forgiveness.
Even, I think that the concept of repentance and forgiveness don't necessarily go directly to whether the person has changed their basic impulses and needs. So that, for instance, the example comes to me not from politics. It would be somebody, for instance, who's an alcoholic. That's a medical condition.
Uh-huh.
Nobody can fault a person for being an alcoholic.
Right.
But an alcoholic, let's say, who acknowledges his responsibility, says, this is a problem that I will take responsibility for and succeed, he still would not say, aha, I now forgive you for all of it that you did under the influence of drink. Let's go to the bar together.
Right.
Because that person has a structural issue that he or she has to deal with,
mm-hmm.
and we hope with this religious responsibility of tshuva and then slip up from those who they dealt with and want to see from God. But that's not
right.
But that still doesn't mean, okay, well then, all is forgiven doesn't mean all is forgotten in that sense.
Well, that's correct. If you remember, one of the elements of tshuva is called azivat hachet, forsaking the sin. And if you remember, the Chovat HaLevavot explains very specifically that azivat hachet does not simply involve not sinning, but it involves extricating yourself from those situations in which you intend to lose your willpower.
When the sin is perhaps related to an abuse of power, then seeking power again on the basis of having asked and received forgiveness for that former abuse of power is like thinking.
Well, it's a good point. I mean, it may be the power that's the addiction. That's a good point. It may be the power itself that creates the environment in which one sins. It's very, very true. Okay, so that's just some comments on political leadership, and again, it's fascinating that we can go back to something written in the 15th century and at least see some contemporary insight into the political issues that we face. Now, coming to the topic for today, I asked you, although I know I'm not supposed to mention Maimonides in this course, but yeah, I did think that you cannot ignore the writings of the Rambam in Jewish philosophy. To use the irreverent metaphor, I shouldn't say it, I'll say it this way, it's like, you know, the 2,000-pound elephant that you just, you know, it's in the room. You cannot make believe it's not there, because Maimonides looms so gigantically in the history of Jewish philosophy generally. And a lot of writings are simply playing off Maimonides, accepting, rejecting, qualifying, commentating on, etc. So at the very least, I thought we would just look at the 13 principles of faith, what they basically mean, and their various statements and restatements, because they do appear in three different standard forms. It's very interesting. The first articulation of the 13 principles of faith, and by the way, there is a mystical significance, it is said, to the number 13. 13, actually, do you remember, if you're still up, this part of the Seder, the next to the last song of the Seder, right, who knows one, right, etc. So the last number is, who knows 13, right, how fast you can sing that. So it says, Shalosha Asar Midaya, which is Aramaic. 13 are the Midot, the attributes. Now what attributes are we referring to? So there are really three interpretations. There's three places of 13. There are the 13 attributes of divine mercy that we say during Slichot and the Ilah, that when Moshe was praying for after the sin of the golden calf, Hashem taught him the midot of Rachamim, Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum v'chanun, God is merciful. There are the 13 principles of interpretation of the Torah, Rabbi Yishmael's 13 principles of expository analysis, exposition, and then some related to the 13 principles of faith, 13 principles of emunah can also be called the midot. And in fact, in various lists, there are some complicated, although some of it is a little artificial, complicated correlations in which each of the 13 principles of faith can be correlated to the 13 principles of interpretation, can be correlated to the 13 attributes of divine mercy. There are connections that different svarim make in that connection. The number 13, though, does have a mystical significance. Well, bar mitzvah, of course, is 13, not mitzvah is 12, but the number 13 has a mystical number because it symbolizes the union of God and the Jewish people. Because the Jewish people are 12 tribes, and God is one. And the word echad, unity, what's the numerical equivalent? Aleph is one, chet and dalet is 12. So echad, the unity, the fusion of the Jewish people and God, creates a unity in the number 13. So 13 does have, unlike the superstition that 13 is an unlucky number, I know even in many buildings don't have a 13th floor. In my law school, I don't know how it is in other law schools, I don't remember when I was a student, but when exam numbers are assigned to students, there is no number 13. That's unbelievable that they still have to follow that, but no student gets a number 13.
But that's a Christian-based thing, because there were 13 people at the Last Supper.
That's right, that's
and
right.
And it's supposedly on the 13th day.
Right, 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 right. So 13 in Christianity has an unfortunate connotation, but 13 actually is a very, very mystical number in Judaism as well, in a positive way. But be it as it may, the formulation of these 13 principles appears in three sources. The authoritative formulation appears in the, and that's what you have in your anthology, appears in the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah, right? The Rambam wrote a commentary on the entire Mishnah, and although generally the Rambam's commentary is very short and concise, but in his introduction to the 11th chapter of Sanhedrin, which actually the Rambam had it as the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin, now what is that chapter? That chapter begins with a famous passage that many of you might think is in Pirkei Avot, although it's not. It says, "Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelek le'olam haba." All of Israel has a share in the world to come. Now, when you study Ethics of the Fathers, you will notice that every time you begin Ethics of the Fathers, you always recite that. But that is not in Ethics of the Fathers. That is taken from a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, and we recite it as part of Ethics of the Fathers to put us in a frame of mind in which we recognize that as Jews we have a share in the world to come. But of course, keep in mind that that taking out of a half phrase is very misleading, because it says all of Israel has a share in the world to come, and the following don't have a share in the world to come. And then it gives you a pretty long list. So it's not quite as inclusive as the first line would suggest. But in that Mishnah, which discusses, after all, various heresies which would deny a person a share in the world to come, Maimonides has an introduction to that Mishnah, a very long introduction of three printed pages, in which he discusses some of the fundamentals of Jewish faith. Right, so that is the authoritative exposition of at least Maimonides' views on those 13 principles. The second source in which you find the 13 principles, and contrary to popular opinion, this is not written by Maimonides at all, is the statements that are begin, Ani ma'amin be'emunah shleima, I believe with perfect faith. And then it enumerates, A, right, 1, 2, 3, as you know, that famous Ani ma'amin that Jews sang when they went to the gas chambers, I believe in the coming of the Mashiach. That is really principle 12 of those 13 Ani ma'amins, right? But there are 13 principles. Now, what's interesting is the Ani ma'amin is of anonymous authorship, and it was an attempt to restate in popular language the 13 principles of Maimonides. However, there are occasional discrepancies between the official formulation in the commentary of the Mishnah and the more popular formulation in the Ani ma'amin. And I'll try to point it out as we go along, just so you'll be aware of that. And the third place in which the 13 principles are stated, and again, many of you may know this, but it may be new to some of you, is in the famous hymn, Yigdal. Right? The song, Yigdal, Elohim Chai, which in a siddur is actually part of the daily service, but many people don't say it every day, but it's commonly sung Friday night or Shabbat morning, different synagogues, either that or Adon Olam. Adon Olam is not the Yud Gimel Ikarei Emunah, but Yigdal, every line in Yigdal is supposed to correspond with one of the Yud Gimel Ikarei Emunah. And this is actually very accurate. In other words, I noticed, and I'll point out, some of the discrepancies between the Ani ma'amin and the official formulation do not apply to the Yigdal prayer, which, again, as far as I know, there's only one word in Yigdal that seems to be a little out of sync, but you know, I'll point it out as we go along. Right, so now you understand why Yigdal is sung, because at the end of a service, what a Jew might want to do is affirm the principles of the faith. Right? So it's kind of an affirmation of principles. Now, just to know a little bit of the history here, Maimonides wrote his commentary on the Mishnah in Arabic. Right? He did not write it in Hebrew. And he wrote it at a very young age. He completed the work at the age of 22. So I don't know exactly when he started. I don't know how long it took him, but he completed the work at a very, very young age. He wrote it in Arabic because, as was common, just like the Chovat HaLevavot, that was the popular language in the centers of Jewish culture that Maimonides lived in. He wrote it when he was already in Egypt. And it was an amazing thing to articulate what might be called a definitive creed of Judaism. There really was no previous list of things that a Jew has to believe. If you asked the average Jewish rabbi, what do Jews have to believe in? They would answer, a Jew has to believe in the Torah, whatever the Torah says. And if you recall the excerpt, a lot of the people who came after Maimonides had a lot of problems with, what do you mean by 13 principles of faith? First of all, one of your principles is, I believe everything in the Torah is true. So if you believe everything in the Torah is true is a principle of faith, then why do you have to say anything else? In other words, this was the Abarbanel's problem. And this was Rav Albo's problem, right? As we indicated before, why did Rav Albo write Sefer Ikarim? Because he essentially said that Maimonides' principles, which are called Ikarim, foundations or roots, are not really principles. The only three principles, Albo said, was there is a God, there is revelation of his will, and there's reward and punishment. Everything else are subcategories and the like. So there's a tremendous difficulty. Although Maimonides' principles, see, again, we have to differentiate this. The substance of his principles, virtually every philosopher and rabbi who was faithful to the Jewish tradition believes it. Everybody believed in it. But the issue of classification, why these 13, why not other things? For example, there are curious omissions in Maimonides' list. Just to mention two. Maimonides does not mention, as in Nikar, the concept of free will. Although Maimonides writes in many, many places the fundamental importance of free will for the concept of responsibility and tshuva, but he does not mention bechira as opposed to predetermination as an ikar. Another thing he doesn't mention, although you might infer it from the ikar, is he does not mention that the world was created out of nothing. That's called briah, creation ex nihilo, briah yesh me'ayin, which are fundamental principles, right? So there are issues here in terms of why so many and why so few, meaning there are things that don't make the list. And then, if one of the Ikarim is everything is in the Torah is true, why do you mention other things? Yeah. Yes, that could be very true. That's correct. One might argue, it's a good point, one might argue that free will does not have to be stated as an independent principle, because if one of the Ikarim is that God rewards virtue and punishes evil, either in this world or the next world, that presupposes volition and will. That Maimonides makes that argument in the Mishneh Torah, in his halachic work, where he says reward and punishment could not be justified unless human beings had the capacity to make choices. Right? Although we feel like kicking the computer, right? But morally the computer should not be kicked when it fails to respond, unless that would fix it somehow, because the computer has no choice. You only punish or reward that which has choice. So you're making a very good point that it is possible that the Ikar could be derived, but I'll tell you a question on that. Maimonides mentions, we'll go over this, one of the Ikarim is God knows what we do. Now one might equally argue that that could be inferred from reward and punishment, right? So the answer is, if he's stating these things separately, then he could have stated Bechira separately as well.
We say that God is one, and we also say he's responsible for all creation.
Yes.
Therefore, it can be inferred that there was nothing existing aside from God that came from
nothing. It would so seem, and I agree that that's also a reasonable inference, but it seems from the Moreh Nevuchim that the Rambam does not, in fact, accept that inference. In fact, the Rambam writes in the Moreh Nevuchim that he would be willing to accept as a matter of logic the eternity of matter if he felt that this was logically inescapable. In other words, he says he could interpret the Judaism consistently with the eternity of matter, but he then tried to show that Aristotle's argument was based on falsity, meaning he did not see inescapably a contradiction. Although I admit that I actually don't follow that reasoning either, but he did not see a contradiction between.
Why did he necessary
say that? Why did he find it necessary?
Did he believe that he didn't want to paint Judaism in a form?
I think that was so, because, again, he's addressing his work to Aristotelian people. Aristotle had a very strong conviction of eternity of matter. So essentially, Maimonides was almost willing to concede that, which might be why he didn't call it an Ikar, because even though he believes in Yesh Me'ayin, creatio ex nihilo, but he did not consider it a fundamental foundation of faith.
What does he bring for support? The fact that the first pasuk in Bereishis talks about water was in existence, that the Spirit of God was hovering over the water.
Yeah, he goes to the different verses,
yeah.
But it's a very, very intricate argument in the first part of the Moreh Nevuchim, but he does acknowledge the theoretical possibility of Kadmutz, which is eternity of matter. Okay, so those are just some comments, but be it as it may, if you remember the excerpt, but the point is that it was an extraordinary intervention for such a young person who had no particular authority in the Jewish community. He had no position, so to speak. This was not done in some type of conclave or convention or meeting or assembly, to simply say, these are what Jews must believe in. Of course, we'll have to discuss what happens if you don't believe in them. What would Maimonides say about a person who doesn't believe in them? And he has some very, very harsh words about that as well. But I just want to go over what the principles are, what they say, and the various disagreements that others have had with him. For example, okay, we'll get into the list. Yeah.
Hopefully not the right time to do this, but I'm curious where the creatio ex nihilo becomes something that Rambam either has to defend or deal with. Where did it come from originally when the text itself seems to be equivocal about it? At least my understanding is that Rashi interpreted the first iteration as being equivocal about that. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I'm asking. So where did it start if the text itself does not point to
it? Just to take your second point first, I don't think Rashi is equivocal. Rashi just has a somewhat of an unusual translation of the first verse, because Rashi says that the word bereshit means in the beginning of, and therefore it can't just be in the beginning, comma, and therefore it says, in the beginning of the creation of the universe, God did certain things. In other words, as opposed to, it's simply where you put the comma, and whether the first pasuk is a complete sentence or a subordinate dependent clause of the following sentence.
Although it does have implications in terms of how you see the actions and what the underlying ground of action would be.
Right,
if it takes place in the beginning of something, then that something is there.
That doesn't happen. I mean, that's a possible interpretation. That is certainly not a necessary interpretation.
Right.
Because I could say in the beginning of refers to the beginning of the process which culminated in these finished products. In other words, you could say in the beginning of the process which made all of these things.
But apparently pre-existed as a dogma, and that's why I'm wondering
where is the definitive source of Yesh Meayin? It would seem that it is connected to the notion of the absolute unity of God, because if there is anything that was around as long as God was around, in other words, then there is not a true unity of God. The unity presupposes that there was nothing which coexisted. But again, I don't remember what the oldest source that made that explicit is. But that certainly was the basically the universal consensus in rabbinic Judaism of the creation ex nihilo. Yeah.
I'm sorry, Jeff, you know, that's formally,
again, I want to emphasize that there's virtually nothing that Maimonides enumerates that was not accepted as things Jews believe in, and certainly in the polemical work of Rav Sadia Gaon and Menorah Gedeot, he deals with the notion of creation ex nihilo, free will, which are not on Maimonides' list, Mashiach, resurrection of the dead, God is not corporeal, there's no body, there's unity, there's eternity, etc. So Rav Sadia Gaon touched on all of these things, and in fact it was suggested really that Maimonides' list is not based so much on these are the 13, but it's based on the fact that these were matters of controversy with sectarian groups, and it was necessary to affirm their primacy. Meaning, the issues which were controversial, disputed, not accepted by breakaway groups like the Karaites and the various Aristotelians and Neoplatonists and the like, those were the ones that Maimonides picked. Again, it's a little difficult. Maimonides seems to describe these as fundamental, not merely controversial. But certainly you could find a discussion of all of these principles in Rav Sadia Gaon's work, but Rav Sadia Gaon never wrote that, you know, these is a definitive creed. Now, the way Maimonides is often understood is the following. Because again, the Barbanel's fundamental question is, right, the Barbanel, who is a very philosophical person, is actually unphilosophical there. He says, what do you have to start listing things? You believe in the Torah, right? That's it. You believe in anything. What do you mean, I believe in 13 things? And therefore, he disagrees with the whole approach of Ikarim. When there's Ikar, that implies there's a Tafel. Secondary, there's no such thing. Everything's important. But the way Maimonides is often explained is the following. There's a distinction between commitment and knowledge. And let me give you an example, practically, from the laws of conversion. Part of Geirut, at least according to Halakha, is that a prospective convert accept upon themselves the Torah and the mitzvot. So a person must be willing to say, I live my life, or I will live my life in accordance with the Torah and the mitzvot. Now, what does that mean exactly? Let's assume the prospective convert, you know, took an introduction to Judaism class for 3 months, but they don't yet know, as all of us don't know, all the Torah and the mitzvot. So how can one realistically say, I commit myself to the Torah and the mitzvot, if they don't yet know all that that entails? And even under halakha, it's absolutely clear, there is no requirement for conversion that the convert, you know, be an ordained rabbi. In other words, they don't have to, not that ordained rabbis know everything either, I mean, they don't have to know everything. It says, we tell them some mitzvot, and they decide that they can live with them. So how do we explain that? That's a contradiction. How can you accept the mitzvot when you don't know the mitzvot? The answer is, that's not a contradiction at all. That's exactly what the Jews did when they accepted the Torah. Na'aseh, we commit ourselves to live by the Torah, and then I engage in the lifelong process in learning what that Torah is. Right? So it is possible for a person to believe in the Torah without a conscious, cognitive awareness of what is there. And that's why Maimonides says, one of those 13 principles is, you got to believe everything the Torah is true. But the difference is, the 13 principles, one has to have actual knowledge and awareness. In other words, the commitment to living as a Jew, this is Maimonides' view, and again, not everybody agrees with this view, but Maimonides' view is that commitment to living as a Jew without consciously knowing as well as believing these 13 principles would impair one's Jewishness. Meaning, the difference is this. If I don't know there's such a thing as Shabbat, God forbid, I don't know there's a thing as Shabbat, but I believe and I'm willing to live by whatever is in the Torah, meaning if somebody would show me the Shabbat is in the Torah, I would do it. But I just don't know it's there. I am still fully identified as a Jew by virtue of my commitment to the Torah. But if I don't,
consequences. Now, I could say, it's not my fault. I never had the training. But the answer is, okay, it's not your fault. That's fine. No one's going to punish you for what you had to do. But the job wasn't done. And Rav Chaim made the point, it's a very disheartening point, and some disagree with it. Rav Chaim made the point, when it comes to defective perceptions of God, ignorance, excuse, exoneration are not relevant factors, because the issue is not one of punishment. The issue is being qualified to be connected to God in Olam Haba. Now, the question you'll ask is, so what does a person do who, according to Maimonides, who did not have these beliefs because they were a kidnapped child, etc.? So the Kabbalists would answer, that's why there's reincarnation, meaning there might be certain solutions in which only the mystical idea of having a second chance would work. And that's really the difference. Maimonides makes the point that the issue of denial of the 13 principles is not one of sin. It's not that there is a sin to deny. Rather, these are the basic qualifications for admission to Olam Haba, to relate to God, without that proper perception. And therefore, I could be ignorant of the whole Torah, and the good things that I do, I'll get rewarded for, etc. But ignorance of this, this is Rav Chaim's famous statement, an apikoros is nebuch an apikoros. In other words, too bad, the heretic is unfortunately still a heretic. And now again, that's a very, I'll try to talk about this, how this would apply today, but that is a very, very harsh judgment. But based on Maimonides' own, again, we're talking about Maimonides' position, based on the logic of his position, this is what will irreducibly flow from those consequences. Yeah.
That being said, do his critics realize what these 13 principles were based on? When they criticized them and said that isn't accepting Voltaire enough?
Yeah.
Did they appreciate what he was getting at? Was yes, you can accept the Voltaire, but your service of God is flawed because you're not really serving the God of Israel.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they understood Maimonides that way, or either they didn't understand him, or they understood it and they rejected it. I know, for example, Rav Avram ben David, the Ravid, who wrote criticisms on the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah, the halachic work, and the Ravid, who lived in France, was very, very harsh often in his criticisms of Maimonides' ruling. Although he had a great admiration for him, he would often say, he's wasted too much paper here, etc. Or if Maimonides would ask a question and gave an unsatisfactory answer, like free will and determination, God's omniscience. So the Ravid said, if he couldn't give a decent answer, he shouldn't have raised the question. The Ravid was very harsh. Now, in particular, when Maimonides writes in the Mishneh Torah, the idea of God without a body is so fundamental, the Ravid has a comment that says, many people better than him believe that God does have some type of physical form. And the way the commentaries explain it, though, is the Ravid was not saying God has a body. He was saying that the erroneous belief that God has a body does not qualify as defective worship. So that seems to underscore the idea that he understood what the Rambam was trying to get at, and he disagrees, as Rav Alba would disagree. But it is a complicated area in this sense. But be it as it may, again, I'm not giving you my position, I'm giving you Maimonides' position, is that these 13 principles occupy a different place in the pantheon, that's the proper term for this, in the pantheon of religious principles, in the sense that there must be actual cognitive awareness as belief, as opposed to the generic, general belief, everything in the Torah is true. Now, in the in his introduction, he goes on to a number of peripheral points, just worthy of mention, before he gets to the principles. He differentiates. He talks about the different ideas of reward and punishment that people have. And again, he's saying that some people have a very physical understanding of reward and punishment, which is really based on the Arabic and Islamic philosophy. Kind of, you'd be drinking wine and eating grapes and fruits all day in paradise. Maimonides was delicate enough not to mention the 800 whatever it is, women that one is surrounded with, whatever the number is. Some talk about success in this world, etc. Maimonides himself says that a lot of these are in error, and he says the ultimate reward is the communion of the soul with God, which is a spiritual, unending pleasure that we cannot perceive with our senses, But he does make a very interesting point, a very interesting practical point, that he says we do see that even in our physical lives, the pleasures that are more of the spirit bring a person much more satisfaction. I mean, he even gives that in the negative way. He says people will often hurt themselves in order to inflict harm on another person. If I'm angry at you, right? So I will not show up, let's say, to a wedding or a bar mitzvah, even though I'd have a great time, because I want to hurt you. Now, that's a dysfunctional negative way. But what does that show? That shows that a person is willing to give up food, physical enjoyments, in order to indulge their spirits in a negative, destructive way. Or a person gives up many things for honor, for glory. So Maimonides is making the point that even in this world, matters of the spirits often make more of a difference to a person than physical pleasures. And kal v'chomer a fortiori in olam haba, where the communion with God is eternal and intense, it is spiritual, there is no pleasure as great as that. Now I should say, one can write an essay on this. Generally speaking, Maimonides does disparage, I mean again, this is consistent with much rabbinic tradition, but he does disparage more than some others pleasures of the flesh. Again, this is Aristotle has a similar idea, but Maimonides focuses very much on the idea that the ultimate joys in life are joys of the mind, intellectual, joys of the spirits, and he does disparage the enjoyment of the physical world. Now again, in our Chachamim, in the Gemara, things are a bit more equivocal. Obviously, Judaism is not predicated on a hedonistic philosophy of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. Obviously, one should focus on the spiritual values, and yet we find in the Jewish tradition that the world is also something that one should enjoy. For example, the famous scenario of the Nazir. The one who takes a vow to abstain from wine is considered a sinner in the Jewish tradition, because according to Rashi's explanation based on a statement in the Gemara, because he deprives himself of the pleasures of the world. So Judaism has a balance. Judaism is not an ascetic religion that renounces pleasure. And yet it must be said that Maimonides, although he talks about the middle way, does have a sense of disparagement. Again, frankly, okay, sometimes it's described, I don't mean this in a negative way, but there's a certain intellectual elitism in which the only worthwhile thing in life is the intellectual contemplation. And Maimonides' view of Olam Haba is you get that supreme intellectual contemplation of connection with God for 24 hours a day, all the time, right? And this is the greatest pleasure. And it's not the wine and the grapes and the physical. And that's what is called Olam Haba in his definition. The notion of communing with intellectual perception of the complexity of the universe and the divine connection to God. Now, the way others would describe it, they also describe Olam Haba as totally ethereal, totally spiritual, but they would define it more as the feelings of love and intimacy and connection. So they're not contradictory in any way, but Maimonides kind of gears it more to the joy of pure comprehension, and others would say the joy of pure experience of love. Yeah.
Is this the realm's own thing, or is it something that you see in line with philosophical thought? It's something you have to state, for example,
Because you mentioned the philosopher's perspective. Yes. Of what one should be doing, he discusses a similar pursuit of attaching yourself to some sort of active intellect. That's correct. The active intellect, of course, that's correct. Yes, the highest. So is the Rambam saying an original idea here, or is he? No, this was the way the idea of the active intellect is in fact an Aristotelian formulation. In other words, see what the Rambam based on. The Rambam quotes a passage in the Talmud. See, it says, "What is Olam Haba? The tzaddikim sit, v'yatroteihem b'rasheihem, their crowns are on their head, v'nehanin miziv hashchina, and they derive pleasure from the radiance of the divine presence." That's in the Talmud. Maimonides explains that phrase as their limited mind becomes linked to the active intellect, the cosmic intellect. And that intellectual connection is what gives you pleasure. Now, the Talmud doesn't say precisely that that is the aspect, right? Remember, that's how Maimonides understands that teaching. The notion of the active intellect, which is out there, and the Aristotelian idea was that by contemplation, by removal from physicality, by disengagement from materialism, you somehow connect what's here with that which is out there. And that is unity with the Godhead, which is perceived as you know, the intellectualization in a manner that we cannot perceive. That is ultimately the reward for God's commandments. He then makes a very important point, which is one of the most famous points Maimonides makes. He makes this in his commentary to the Mishnah, and he makes this in the Mishneh Torah, in his halakhic work as well. And that is, wait a second here. How can we make the claim that reward for the commandments is all Olam Haba? Now granted, empirically that makes sense, because we see plenty of righteous people who don't get reward. So it is sensible to say ultimate reward is Olam Haba. That's fine. But it seems to contradict the claim of the Torah itself. What does the Torah always say? The Torah always says, if you keep the commandments, you'll have rain, you'll have prosperity, you'll have fertility, you'll have health, etc. The Torah only emphasizes the brachot of Olam Hazeh. It does not emphasize the brachot of Olam Haba. That's why we always say Judaism is a this-worldly religion, although Olam Haba is fundamental in our belief. So here Maimonides articulates the very well-known idea that the benefits that God gives a person for keeping the Torah are not in the nature of reward. Reward is only up there. Rather, they are in the nature of opportunity. What does that mean? That when a person, let's say, is ill, or a person is poor, or a person is oppressed, they often do not have the opportunity to serve God properly. They cannot do the mitzvot that they want to do. Therefore, what God says is, you know, if you show that you're willing to serve me even under adversity, the reward that I will give you in this world is I will give you the opportunity to do more mitzvot by removing some of the constraints that prevent you from doing the mitzvot. Meaning, the only purpose of anything we get in this world that's good is not to reward us for what we've done, but to give us the opportunity to do more. And that's the meaning of the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, Sechar Mitzvah, the reward for a mitzvah, is mitzvah, the ability to do more. Right? This is the famous idea, therefore, that reward is not reward. Reward is opportunity. And that, by the way, may explain the concept of what one might call negative opportunity, meaning to say, people ask the question, well, but there are still righteous people who don't get these good things. Right? That's not fair, right? That's Job's question. But it might be, the answer might be this. If it be true that the good things that happen are merely there to create opportunities, then God, looking at certain individual people, might very well make the decision that for those individual people, their greatest opportunities for growth precisely come through the adversities and challenges that they face. You see, if this would be a matter of reward, if it would be a matter, you did good things, so you should get reward, then it wouldn't be right to tell the righteous person, we're not going to give you the reward. But if reward as such is Olam Haba, and this world is simply the world of opportunity, then indeed one can understand how sometimes it might be precisely the most righteous person of all who can demonstrate the greatest resilience, the greatest courage. Right? Again, I refer to Viktor Frankl's work, I refer to a number of times, in which he shows that it was precisely in the confrontation with the depths of despair and the depths of evil in the world that brought out the greatest compassion and transformation in people. In other words, this doesn't totally answer anything, but all I'm saying is that if you look at the events of this world as opportunities rather than payoffs, then one can understand how God might strike the balance differently for individuals as to what creates the opportunities for them to realize their potential. For some people, their potential might be realized only in a relatively comfortable life, because some people get broken and defeated. Right? For other people, it might be precisely their ability to rise to a challenge which will make them who they're able to become. Yeah.
The world is governed by physical laws. Why would we assume that there's a transaction going on here at all that is not the, and the reward, we accept Maimonides' idea that the reward is in the Olam Haba.
Yes.
And why is there a transaction, why do we need to assume there's a transaction at all in terms of the individual situation of a person, the one who follows mitzvot and is and lives in hardship, and the one who seems to be evil but is given the goods of the world? Why should that be an issue at all? Because it seems to me that the only the only non-physical law governed issue here would be the will of the individual to pursue God's word, as opposed to a continuing transaction that says, that God would say, I'm going to change the physical laws in order to give this one this and this one that. Not that God couldn't, but that ordinarily we assume the world is governed by physical law.
Yeah.
The only thing that's not physical would be the will.
The will, that's correct. Well, you know, you have a very good question as a matter of logic, but you still are going to have a textual difficulty, and that is, we still have all these verses in the Torah that do seem to say, if you follow the rules, these things are going to happen to you. In other words, what you're saying could be accepted as a matter of theoretical theology, but you still have an inconsistency with the text of the Torah.
What if that is indeed the physical law? What if that is part of the physical law? Again, the Torah, I don't think, is to be viewed as making a distinction between, say, physics or chemistry and the way the world works. The Torah is pre-science and maybe includes science in its physical law. That these are the consequences. These are simply the consequences of what happened when you do these things. Because in fact, a lot of what Torah says, very practical stuff.
Some of it might be true. I mean, I could agree that if you keep the sabbatical year, and therefore you have crop rotation and leave the land fallow, it's more likely you'll have, but certainly...
We have to evaluate that in order for it to be true. In other words, we don't have to say which are the better... I'm not saying that therefore you get to look in Torah and say, we'll follow this and not follow this. Because we could accept that the Torah is saying, this is the way the world works, these are the consequences of these actions.
Overall.
And and then the reward... Where your field of action is in free will, and God's response to your free will is reward or punishment.
Okay, so but then you're suggesting essentially that God has kind of created a structure which is self-perpetuating, self-operative, based on scientific
reality. Well, not exactly science, but on cause. That is to say, not...
And the cause includes the spiritual cause.
That's what I'm, without analyzing it at this point, that's what I'm proposing. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think that is a possibility. I think that, in fact, in other places, Maimonides actually seems to say what you've said. And that is that God kind of creates a mechanism that works a certain way, and only occasionally will there be direct divine intervention in that mechanism, like splitting of the Red Sea or the like. But again, that does create a certain distance between God and the universe that others don't accept. Others view God as having more of a continuing relationship with the world, in which there are interventions all the time, but as Maimonides says, the interventions are in the nature of opportunity, not in the nature of payoffs. I mean, they're just stating a different position than he's stating here.
Right.
But in the eight chapters, in the introduction to Pirkei Avot, he does state a position similar to yours.
There's more to be said here, obviously, and the danger is of looking backward with a modern post-Kantian philosophical view on a text that doesn't know those issues, or that is pre-scientific.
Right. And you know, what you're saying is also similar to Rabbi Kushner's argument in why do bad things happen to good people, in which, you know, God creates a world in which things happen, and God is not directly connected to the individual consequences. There are cosmic consequences, the Torah, not Torah, but they don't pertain to the individual in Olam Hazeh. Olam Haba is a different story. Yeah.
There's one textual problem that applies to what you're saying. I was wondering how the Rambam would interpret it, which is that there is one mitzvah where God guarantees on a personal level that you'll be rewarded right away. With regard to giving tzedakah, God says that you will be rewarded personally. If you give tzedakah, you have money to come back to you.
Yes.
So, A, on his point, that's a personal interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I also would be wondering, the Rambam had to say on that thing also, God's rewarding you with the opportunity to do more.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Or you just have more money, that's a reward.
No, absolutely. In fact, he says it specifically regarding this. One of his examples, God will give you more money so you can give more charity. I mean, that's exactly the same. I mean, that's consistent with everything. He does not mention previous Jewish philosophers. In fact, he doesn't really mention. I mean, basically, I don't want to say he only derived it from Aristotle, because he derived it from many rabbinic sayings as well. But he seemed to favor rabbinic sayings. You know, in Chazal, you could find statements pro and con, and the Rambam tends to emphasize and pull forward the statements that disparage physical pleasure. If anything, I'll tell you what a big influence might have been. A big influence might have been his medical practice, although he was not yet a doctor when he wrote the commentary to the Mishnah, because he writes in the Mishnah Torah that most illnesses that come to people come from overindulgence in eating and drinking and sexual pleasure. So I think he just saw people ruining themselves with indulgence, and he kind of said it was a bad thing.
I've never seen it. I was wondering, it's spiritual sensitivity, but I know that he's a young man.
Well, perhaps it was so. You know, I mean, on one level, though, the Rambam certainly did not respond to the persecutions by kind of a separatist, for example, the way the German Jews did, in which they rejected secular culture because they said, "Look what it's done." I mean, the Rambam was still all of his life deeply involved in the intellectual currents of the secular culture. So he did not take the persecutions as a sign of rejecting that. But it's interesting, if you take someone like Yehuda Halevi, it is very interesting. Yehuda Halevi was before the Rambam, on one hand, a great, great religious philosopher, but he also wrote secular poetry. He did write secular poetry, including some romantic poetry, some songs about wine, etc. So there was a different perspective that was often not understood today, and certainly the Rambam would not view those activities with favor. But it just seems to be, I don't know, by temperament. What was the phrase? I'm trying to remember. There was a phrase somebody once described the Rambam's neshama. I don't remember the phrase. It was a very interesting phrase. But just his neshama was, you know, super rational, philosophical, intellectual. Even when he describes Olam Haba. Right? It's described as uniting yourself with the active intellect, which is the greatest, you know, pleasure that one could possibly perceive. And, you know, the Gemara never discusses it in those terms. The Gemara discusses it in allegorical phrases, which might mean that, but there's nothing compelling that it does mean that. But that's how, when the Rambam envisions what is the greatest possible thing a human being could ever have, this is what the Rambam comes up with. You know, in this day and age, to our, you know, diminishment, you know, we don't necessarily have that connection to ideas, and consequently we don't always understand. Now that's, again, that doesn't mean the Rambam is wrong, it may mean we're diminished, we're wrong, but nevertheless we sometimes find it a little difficult to connect with the Rambam on that level. Alright, so that, yeah.
Could it also be when you're 22 years old you think you know, like it's a function of age that you never know as much.
No, but I'll tell you one amazing thing. One amazing thing about the Rambam is that the Rambam wrote over many years. The Rambam wrote over 50 years. Right? The Moreh Nevuchim was already when the Rambam was 70. And there's a remarkable consistency. Meaning what the Rambam wrote when he was 20 is mirrored in what the Rambam wrote when he was 70. So he had formed his foundations at a very young age. And he stuck with it. He developed it, obviously. He became much more in depth. But he writes the same things in the Moreh Nevuchim as well. Yeah.
What is known about his life, his family, in terms of his inherent knowledge?
Well, I tell you, there's a professor who's the head of the Cairo Geniza Project in Cambridge University, Professor Stephen Reif, who actually is going to be in Baltimore in the Shabbat. He was in our synagogue a few years ago. He described, the Cairo Geniza, for thousands of years, people were throwing in, used Jewish books and the like. And Salman Schechter actually was the first person who really went in and made a very intensive exploration of the contents of the Cairo Geniza. And in there, and Rabbi Reif, Dr. Reif is now in charge of the that project. So he unearthed a letter of someone who had visited. He had visited Maimonides, and he had taken his small son to visit Maimonides for a Shabbat. And it was very, very interesting. He got a totally different view of Maimonides when he comes in, and Maimonides was such a gracious. And Maimonides, of course, was held at the highest esteem in the whole Jewish world. And he talks about the fact that Maimonides was so happy to have a guest, and when he left the room, so the Rambam's only son, Avraham ben HaRambam, told the little boy, he says, when my father comes back, call him grandfather. He loves when kids call him, grandfather. So when he came back in the room, my son called him, Saba. And the Rambam hugged him and kissed him. Oh, and he served him lemon cake and candy, So there obviously was another side. The Rambam had, I know nothing about the Rambam's wife. I really do not. The Rambam was, in the early years of his career, supported by his brother, who was a jewel merchant. And that enabled the Rambam to study and learn. And his brother David was lost at sea.
There's a beautiful letter in the last letter that they exchanged.
Right. Yeah, they were very, very close. It wasn't just his economic support. They were very, very close. And the Rambam had to work. The Rambam had to get a job, and that's really when he became he was a professor of philosophy for a while. Then he became a physician, and he became the physician to the royal caliph in Cairo. And he really worked. It's amazing. I mean, he wrote the Mishneh Torah very late at night. It took him 20 years. After a day of medical practice, and when he would come home, there would be patients and people asking halachic questions, and whole rooms of people. And he had not eaten anything all day, and he describes he had a little bit of a meal, and he would then work with people for 2 or 3 hours into the night. And then, after the room emptied, he would be able to write something. So it was just remarkable that he was able to accomplish this. He only had one son, Avraham, who himself was a very, very great rabbi, who was a great defender of his father, because the Maimonides controversies had erupted in terms of his philosophy and the like. And it had continued after his death as well, and one of the great defenders was Avraham ben HaRambam, who wrote treatises and books defending his father's rulings. But in terms of the Rambam's wife, I really do not know. It's very interesting. It was a very reticent, non-public type of relationship. Yeah. I'm sorry.
There's also a continuing notion here that Rambam had the hardship of losing his beloved brother. Who knows what kind of work he would have done? Would it have been as good? My contention would be that this hardship gave him the opportunity to deal directly with people as a physician and to understand the hardships that ordinary people went through, and perhaps this would have changed for the better. You can always ask the question, if anybody's ever had a long conversation with a 14-year-old, I know that they know all the answers because they're very logical. They see the world in black and white.
That's
and
right.
It's very hard to make them understand. Sometimes you have to say, look, when you're older, you'll know. Why is that the case? Why should logic be subservient to maturity?
Right.
But this, in a way, that it's through that interaction with the world, they're rubbing up against the edges of it that you learn maybe.
Well, again, that's an excellent point, and that ties into the Rambam's own thesis that what happens in our lives are the opportunities that God gives us to serve Him better. And, it's always a fascinating speculation. What would the Mishneh Torah have looked like had the Rambam been able to write, in the library setting of perfect contemplation? And yet, the Rambam had to deal with the world as he saw it.
I'm kind of afraid to ask this question, but did you ever hear the rumor that at the end of his life the Rambam converted, that he left Judaism and what he converted to? Did you ever hear that?
No, I have not heard that.
You've never heard that rumor?
No, I have heard it. I have heard it of other people. I have heard, in other words, there were, unfortunately, in the course of Jewish history, there were some eminent people, great rabbis. I have never heard of Maimonides, but I'll check. If you've heard it,
maybe. I did not hear it.
I have a feeling, though. I have a feeling that if that is recorded anywhere, it possibly may have been a rumor that was started by one of the extreme opponents. I mean, they were not beneath that mudslinging. So it is possible you might find that written somewhere, but my guess would be that, you know. That's very interesting. You know, because one of the famous that's fascinating. You know, one of the famous letters that the Rambam wrote, Igeret Teiman, which we had studied in an earlier course, was a defense of the idea that Jews who had converted forcibly because of threats to their lives, but who kept Judaism in secret, like later Maranos, should be treated as full-fledged members of the Jewish community, because even though they should have given their life, so to speak, but if they didn't, you know, we cannot judge them, we cannot condemn them. And the Rambam, and that's an extremely harsh letter, because the Rambam was criticizing a certain rabbi that said, these are not Jews, and the Rambam was uncharacteristically harsh. He was very, very strong. He said, this person is a fool and a Rasha, and he transgresses all the laws in the Torah about not shaming people. And it was really, there's really no letter in the Rambam's work that is as sharp-tongued as that. So you're suggesting perhaps... I don't know. I can't speak to it, but that would explain it. Although, once again, the Rambam himself does concede halachically that's not a proper response. I mean, why don't you give up the right? But who knows? Yeah.
Somewhere in this library, in this building, there is a book of poetry. It includes, I don't know the name of the book, it's very thick, but it includes epitaphs and poems about the Rambam after his death by many, some supported, but many, many opponents.
Yes.
It is very vitriolic.
Well, that could be. I mean, listen, I know in the Hasidic and Misnagate controversies of much later, we do find occasional accusations of conversion to Christianity. You know, they'll just throw that out just to... And of course, keep in mind that certainly the philosophers who disagreed with Maimonides could very well have said, you know, his philosophy is more Islamic than Jewish. I mean, that could have been, you know, a way of putting it as well. But you know, the Rambam, in spite of all the controversies, was so esteemed and venerated in his own lifetime that as far away as Yemen, as far as away, he was very far from Egypt, they actually changed the Kaddish when they would say, may God reveal himself in your lifetime and in the lifetime of Israel. They would add, v'chayechon v'yomechon v'chayei marana v'rabana rab Moshe ben Maimon, in the lifetime of the Rambam. They actually changed the Kaddish to reflect that Moshiach should come in the lifetime of our master, the Rambam.
I just wanted to say that the fact that he wrote at 22 just indicates the fact that he was a genius from very early on.
Yep.
And that
this wasn't his first work, by the way.
And that they are on a totally different plane than even the brightest person that you can imagine.
Well, yeah, I think that's so. I mean, the Rambam was an extraordinary genius, but as you see from this letter, he also liked children, so it's interesting.
Yeah, a genius doesn't mean that he's not human.
So he had a human side too. Yeah.
Isn't it true that the Rainyonim who wrote Shari Shubu was against the Rambam, and the Rambam said that he... was reading his uncle, but Rambam is very good, so he wrote Shari Tshuva because of what happened.
Yeah, the story goes, this is a story, it's not confirmed, but the Chidah says this in his Shem HaGdolim. He writes, there's a famous book on repentance, Shari Tshuva of Rabbeinu Yonah. It's a book, Gates of Repentance. And the story goes that Rabbeinu Yonah, as a youth, was very involved in the book burning of Maimonides' books. And as he grew older, his uncle, who was Rambam, Nachmanides, convinced him that he was in error. And Rabbeinu Yonah felt so bad for getting involved in this that he devoted his life to repentance and teaching others about repentance. And the famous work, Sha'arei Tshuva, is said to be a result of that. And of course, I did mention, though, that around 50 years after the Jews, many Jews burnt Maimonides' books, the Catholic Church burnt 24 wagon loads of Talmud, which destroyed almost all of the Talmuds in the country of France and Germany. And in retrospect, many said this was divine wrath for the disparagement of the Rambam, the Rambam's honor. So, you know. Now, there are also statements, though, that some have said, where the Rambam regretted writing the Guide to the Perplexed. There are statements, because that generated so much controversy that he did express at some point. Maybe it would have been better if I didn't write this book, because I wanted to help people who needed guidance, but instead it's just generating a lot of dissension. So that is a recording.
And what was the basis of all this dissension? Why were people so angry and upset and burning up his books?
Well, there were major issues and there were minor issues. The major issues were the attempt in the Guide to the Perplexed to reconcile Torah faith with Aristotelian philosophy, and the attempt to give rational reasons for all the commandments, which the Rambam does, Tamei Mitzvot, was offensive by many, and many thought that if Jewish people who were not involved in philosophical speculation start opening up the Pandora's box of proving the existence of God and the unity of God, this might undermine a person's faith, because sometimes when you start bringing up questions and the answers may not be as satisfying as the questions, that could lead a person to heresy in a way that they wouldn't had the questions not have been raised in the first place. So the main attack was on the Mori Nevuchim. There were some secondary attacks which I think would not of themselves have caused book burnings, and that is, some were against the fact that the Rambam codified Jewish law without giving his sources. But again, I mean, that would be a debate, but that wouldn't have resulted in all of that. As far as I know, the Mishneh Torah itself was never burnt, except for the first part of the Mishneh Torah, which incorporates some of his conclusions in the Mori Nevuchim about the belief in God and the like, the philosophical part. The halachic part, although that was also criticized, was not burnt or anything like that. Okay, what time do you
one
have?
One more for next time.
Okay, all right, so next time I think we really didn't get, we're going to go over the 13 principles, if you would. I guess one assignment, look at Yigdal in the Siddur, and see, it's not that hard, see if you could match Yigdal with the 13 principles on a line-by-line basis. And also look at the Ani Ma'amin in the Siddur, and compare it to Maimonides' principles as you have it in your anthology. Right? So in the anthology, you have the translation of the 13 principles, which is the official text, and compare it to Yigdal and Ani Ma'amin and see if you can see any discrepancies. Okay, the Ani Ma'amin, at least in a Siddur, appears after the Shachrit, after the morning prayers. And the Yigdal is the Friday night.
Do you know how he dealt with the opposition and the hatred from the community?
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, keep in mind that he was also extremely venerated at the same time. There
wasn't, but also,
well, he wrote letters. He wrote letters about this.
Defending
and
himself.
He defended himself, but he basically said he's not going to get into personal attacks.
He kept himself above.
Absolutely.
It.
He did not get involved. His son got a little more involved. His son was kind of his defender. But he did not want to. First of all, he was already old at the time. And his personality and his midot would not allow him to descend.
Did he have any daughters?
No, he had only one son. One child. Yeah. And the child was very close, and he was really his father's defender in many ways.